Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Humanitarian Horizons, Christina D'Arcangelo Unveiled. And today I have a very important guest. All my guests are important, but specifically today, as we're in April and we're heading into May, which is Mental Health Awareness Month, I am so happy to have Dr. Sanders on. Would you like to tell everyone about yourself and what you've been working on? And welcome.
Thank you, Christine. I'm very happy to be here. My name is Dr. Michelle Sanders. Please call me Michelle. I'm a licensed psychologist in New York State. My area of expertise is in assessment and treatment of PTSD and traumatic reactions. I received my degree from Pace University, my postdoctoral training from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. I was on the faculty of both of these institutions throughout the years. I'm the co-founder and vice chair of FAFI, Female Advocacy Foundation International. We are a 501c3 NGO based on meeting the mental, social, emotional, vocational needs of women and children, especially young girls. Are not limited to young girls, of course. I've done pro bono work for the past 35 years. I started many years ago in New York City working with children with AIDS. In that era, children were segregated and they were put in different hospital rooms, hospital beds, and there wasn't much known about the disease. And there was a tremendous fear of contagion and simply being and a lack of people to care for these children. So, you know, I would rock children at Metropolitan Hospital on the upper East Side of Manhattan. It was really, really incredibly gratifying and also a little anxiety provoking at the same time. But there was a need. And I think that's been my driving force where I've seen a need in humanitarian work via using my mental health background and my tools. That's where I've gone.
Bravo. I think it's fantastic what you've been doing. We connected through LinkedIn because you popped up in my feed, I think, at one point. And I was like, wow. This woman is amazing. I mean, she's really putting herself out there, really trying to help people from the humanitarian side of the world, right? And I don't mean to sound so like wacky when I say that, but we both know how it works in society. And a lot of people will talk about potentially being humanitarian, but they really aren't at the end of the day. So someone like you and seeing where you've been going and nonprofit 501c3 is amazing because it's very hard to be in the 501c3 state. I have one, you know, affinity patient advocacy. And so it's very, very difficult to get people to understand what you're doing and why you're here. And I just want to say bravo.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
So what is going on? Do you have any new projects that you're working on right now that you could talk about that's relative to mental health? And, you know, like I mentioned, when we opened up Mental Health Awareness Month is in May. It should be, in my opinion, and I'm sure you agree, every day. we need to be more aware of mental health, especially since everything we went through as a society in COVID and all the various things that have happened post-COVID and things that are still going on. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on that are important?
Sure. But I'd like to address your last point there. It's quite interesting. I also have a small private practice. And what I've seen and read about in the psychological literature in peer-reviewed journals is that for some people, having gone through COVID, especially for people in New York, it was a re-traumatization for those who went through 9/11, a lack of control. What is anxiety? It's a fear of a lack of control, dealing with ambiguity, uncertainty, and something that was shocking, something that we had no precedence for, no preparation for. And it was isolating at times, right? People were afraid after 9/11. You know, people didn't want to ride the subways. They didn't want to go over bridges and under tunnels. So I saw a parallel there and a correlation.
And a lot of people leaving New York, sorry to interrupt, but a lot of people moved out.
Right. And of course, during COVID, that happened as well. I think people, you know, non-research me, but New Yorker me, people are coming back. So yeah, there's definitely some parallels there. So right now, I personally have always been driven to work with underserved populations, whether that was when I was in the Bronx working with minority populations, people from Afghanistan, yes, from many parts of Latin America, Central America, South America, Mexico, people who had not had access to mental health services. I'm working now on a project with Louise Power. She's one of my colleagues at FAFI, and we are working on a project in Bolivia with underserved women who are single moms, very young single moms, who need access to basic care for themselves, because if moms don't take care of themselves first, they can't take care of a baby. We all know that. And moms are never given enough credit for that, in my belief. And how to care for a child. Bolivia is a very poor country. It's a third world country. There is a dearth of social services, psychiatric services, vocational services. So that's going to fill a real need. And bilingual Spanish, and having lived there, I have a lot of people that I know on the ground. So when you're working internationally in humanitarian work, it's really important to have partners on the ground, because I am not Bolivian. I am like Jewish American woman, right? But I can still connect, but I do need to work with people that are locally, because eventually my footprint will be there. However, I physically won't be there. So our projects, we tend to put a larger footprint so that the people we're working with and for can have more sustainability in what we're doing.
There has to be a bridge of trust built there too, right? Because these poor people, and I don't mean poor economically, I mean sad, it's very sad, that living in this country and they don't have things at their disposal like we take advantage of in the United States, right? We have a lot at our disposal here. And, one would argue, well, it's very hard to get mental health treatment right now because still, I'm sure you can imagine with your private practice, there's still a lot of people with a lot of unresolved issues, things that have been triggering, but we have a different way of life, right? These people don't have that capacity because of where they are. And it's very important to be able to build that level of trust. I know. When we were talking before we came on about like research, right? Because my background is I'm a clinical research person and diversity enrollment of clinical studies are really important. And that goes back to education. We have to make sure we're educating people and we're building that level of trust. So you guys are on the ground building, trying to build this level of trust with people who are already scared. They just had children, a child, or maybe they had more than one, if they had twins or something. And they're trying to just get their heads around what does their life look like now and what can they expect? And it's uncomfortable and it's scary.
And that's a very good point. It's never good practice to come in as the be-all, know-it-all Americans. In order to assess what the need is, it's best to find it out from the people on the ground and not take our values, cultures, rituals, patterns of engagement, and insert that into a culture where it's not going to be wanted, right? It's really important to focus with partners on the ground. And I found that in Bolivia and also in Iraq and Kurdistan, Iraq, where we work with Yazidis. Yazidis are a racial, ethnic, social minority. They are the subject of 75 genocides, the most recent of which was perpetrated by ISIS on August 3rd, 2014. We are coming up on the 10th anniversary of that attack. This was an attack, a genocide against the people, because men were murdered. Women were murdered. Young children were conscripted into the army, young boys into an ISIS ideology, and trained in ISIS videos, propaganda videos. And young girls were taken as slaves. And girls of preteen, teen years were used as sexual slaves and sold to people in Syria, Saudi Arabia, and other Middle Eastern countries. There are still 2,700 missing girls and missing women 10 years out. The Yazidi people are living in tents, similar to a Boy Scout tent or a Girl Scout tent. They are the same tent supplied by the Iraqi government 9¾ years ago. They were supposed to be replaced every year. They are not replaced. There is rampant need for so many services.
How do
For the
you
trauma.
handle, yeah, I was going to say though, too, though, for you, how do you handle this? Because this is very upsetting, like to see this and know all the things that you know about what's going on and the whole background, and you're trying to help because that's a lot to deal with
It's a lot.
mentally. How do you do that? How do you get through that?
I get asked this question frequently, and it always gives me a bit of pause. Surely in my training, I was taught to have a boundary and to know my role. If I cry with a child while I'm doing a clinical assessment, I'm not going to help that child. I need to try to get the best possible performance out of that child that is available, right? So I've learned to have a boundary. With that being said, I am first a human. Then I have all of these other layers to me, like we all do. But first, I'm a human. And it's important to know what my reaction is, to check in with myself. I have a self-check-in that I do frequently, especially when I'm in the field on the ground with people. What's happening with me? Am I thinking about this a lot? Do I want to take a kid home? That could be a red flag. And reaching out for consultation with other psychologists is key. But to go into any kind of this work and to think that one is not going to be affected, I think is incredibly untrue. And if someone is in so much denial, then that's a problem in and of itself, right? So validating the feelings that you're having and normalizing them.
Yeah,
Okay.
I mean, I
So,
know with APA, you know, Affinity Patient Advocacy, we're not ex-US right now. We do get some people that come in that are ex-US that we help, depending upon the, you know, whatever's going on with them. But when I first started APA, it was in 2015. My dad was dying of cancer, and it really opened my eyes to what we really don't know in the pharma sector about patients, oncology patients. And I've worked on a lot of oncology stuff in my career. When we first opened, we were an oncology-focused nonprofit. I had a lot of children that were diagnosed with DIPG. For those of you that are out there listening or watching us, it is when, I won't go into the whole technical terms, but it's when there is a tumor on the brainstem of these children. And a lot of times they get diagnosed at stage four. There's nothing to do that will help them. Radiation chemo does not work. They basically die. I had maybe 10 that we were advocating for. The kids were 12 and under that died. Wow. And we knew, you know, like I'm not stupid when it comes to what's happening, right? I understand what's happening with these kids, especially clinically. I'm not a doctor, but I know I understand clinical things. It was so tough to work and watch these kids die. And it was right after my dad died. So it was like, whew. So that's why I wanted to kind of bring that up, was because here we're doing these things because we're, like, to your point earlier, we're humans, we want to help people. But it's very tough sometimes to navigate through these things because we have a heart and our head and heart are connected. We're not just heads,
Right.
the head and heart connection. So I just wanted to kind of mention that, because that was when I've seen some of your posts come up, I've sat back and I've thought about this. Like, I wonder how she can get through all these things. And you have a whole team of people, you have teams of people and things like that. And you've got to show the strength, the resilience, the dedication. You have to keep delivering because your goal is to help people, but it's upsetting at the same time.
Well, I think to ameliorate or to decrease any potential effects of vicarious traumatization, which is what can happen when someone doesn't directly experience a trauma, but hears about it through orally, reads about it, or sees it in a film or video. And certainly, that's been the case with me, having heard a lot of direct testaments from survivors about their families and the horrors that they experienced, and really the multi-generational transmission of trauma. So along with that is it's important to have self-care. No matter how dedicated I am, I know that I cannot work more than 12, 13 hours in the Iraqi sun. I know that about me. I need to stay hydrated, I need to have meals, and I need some downtime at the end of the day. Maybe that's just looking out on my balcony. Maybe that's reading a book, talking to my children. Something to allow me to feel that I have a life other than what I'm dedicating to my work. It's all about balance. And I think, again, I'll just speak for women in general. I don't think we as women in any of our fields and roles really take enough care of ourselves. Sometimes we do aside from the physical, right? I get my hair colored, I get my nails done. But do I nurture the internal me? Do I nurture my soul, my being? I think that's really important.
I love that you brought that up. Sorry to interrupt, but I'm the same way. You know, like I'm running, running, running. I have multiple companies. I'm a mom, and I know that my son watches everything I do. And so I have to make sure that I do take care of myself in a certain way to show him. But that's just like a kind of like a band-aid, the stuff he sees. I've been having sinus infections, which are minor. Okay. It's not the end of the world or anything like that, but it's happened twice in a matter of 2 weeks apart from one another. So that's my way of my body telling me, okay, you need to slow down, you need to calm down, you need to take some time for yourself. So last week I had to go to the doctors, I had to get another round of antibiotics and things like that. And I'm lucky, at least I live in a country where I can just tool on over to the doctor, get my antibiotics, be seen by a credible person, and go back, you know, home and relax. And so that was basically what I did. I went on Tuesday. Wednesday, I was out of pocket completely. I put my son on the school bus. I mean, he's not a little kid, he's, you know, but I make sure he gets on the school bus, right? And then I checked out completely and I did not work. I slept. I watched things I wanted to watch. I stayed off of my social media and reading because I read a lot, as I'm sure you do, about everything that's going on. And then that just makes me even more like, oh my God. Then I'm like, oh, I have to do something about this and I have to do this and I have to talk about this. And oh my God, take a breath, And that's what I did on Wednesday. And I felt great about it. I didn't feel guilty about it because a lot of times I would feel guilty when I did stuff like this for myself. So I love that you said that because it's so important that you take care of yourself.
And you listen to your body. And we know that the body, when we are in that fight or flight mode, and we're really working our hardest and we're very dedicated, we're very intensely working, that there's more cortisol and more adrenaline flowing through our brains and then ultimately through our bloodstreams. And the body cannot sustain that. We will eventually crash if we don't take care of ourselves. And the goal, of course, is not to crash. I mean, a day, of course, but if you're in country for 4 weeks, you don't want to be crashed for a week of that.
No,
It's such precious
no.
time.
I feel like we could talk about a lot of different things relative to your work. I wanted to start off with, some of the work you've been doing, and I'm glad we got to talk about self-love and self-care and being women and empower leadership positions and really trying to help people and model good behavior for our children at the same time. I really appreciate you talking to me about all these things because it's very important.
And it's part of the work that I do, and the part of the work that so many people in the field do.
That is amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Sanders. I cannot call you by your first name. I don't do that with any of the physicians. I have, as you
Okay.
can imagine, a lot of friends that are doctors, and
Oh.
one doctor is like a brother from another. We've worked
Okay.
together since 16, and his wife, I've become friends with his wife, and his wife's always like, "Well, does he pay you to call him Dr. XYZ?" And I'm like, "No, it's a respect thing. Like I have to call him a doctor because you put your time in, you serve people, you help people. So I that's why I still have to, even though you said, please call me Michelle, I still have to call you Dr. Sanders."
Understood.
Well,
Thank
thank you
you.
so much for being on with me today and sharing a little glimpse into who you are and what you're doing. And I want to thank you for everything you are doing. It's important work. And I think a lot of times it's not that you're looking for applause or a thank you, but I think it's important that those of us that recognize what people are doing, we make sure that we thank people properly.
Truly takes a village. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you again for being on today. And I want to thank our viewers and listeners for always signing in and learning about all the amazing guests that I have on, especially as we're talking about all these very important humanitarian efforts that everyone is working on. Thank you again.